My name is Celeste from Catskill, New York, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Igers Kildas and Louisa Sabin Kildas of Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Quintron's Weather Warlock. Live stream of an analog drone synthesizer played by the weather, made by the New Orleans-based artist Quintron. You can listen to the Quintron Weather Warlock take the changes in weather at Wave Farm in Greene County and hear it anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or go to any WGXC.org webpage and click on the Listen button to hear Quintron's Weather Warlock, turning the changes in precipitation and sunlight and wind and temperature into sound.
This is Ginger Radio Hour on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Justin Maiman. Today, I'm inspired by the woodpecker, especially the pileated. Much more on that later this hour. I interview a woodpecker expert, a tremendous naturalist named Steve Shunk. There's a lot going on with woodpeckers, especially the percussive nature, the drum roll beat that you hear in the forests here in the Catskills. And that got me thinking a lot about Sun Ra and his percussive way of playing the piano, which was also influenced, of course, by a show I saw, an incredible Sun Ra Orchestra show at Opus 40 last Friday. Oh man, the Opus 40 lineup this summer is tremendous. Go check it out. What a perfect place to see live music. Anyway, to get us in the woodpecker mood, here's a live recording of Sun Ra from 1980 at Haverford College. He starts out with Rhapsody in Blue. Thank you. This is Ginger Radio Hour. I'm about to play an excerpt from an extended conversation I had with Steve Shunk. He's a naturalist. He's a woodpecker expert. He's a conservationist. He's based out west in Oregon, where he provides lots of woodpecker tours in Oregon, California, and other places out west. I came across him because he's the author of the incredible book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Woodpeckers of North America. I got a hankering for more info about woodpeckers because I see them all the time in my yard. Downies and hairy, and also, lately, a pileated that used, especially this winter, our yard as a easy and quick place to get a snack. But this book is an incredible collection of information, all sorts of nuggets, all sorts of things you're going to be able to share with your friends. Every woodpecker species in North America is profiled in this book. You should go check it out. I was lucky enough to be able to find Steve after reading this book. And he agreed to chat. He's never been to the Catskills, but he knows all about the birds here, especially the woodpeckers. So here's a full-on Woodpecker 101 course. Just takes about 35 minutes. And by the end, you'll have all sorts of incredible facts to tell your friends. Enjoy.
I was a birder first before I got immersed in woodpeckers. I started birding in about 1990, and I moved to Oregon in 1997 and got a job in Sisters, Oregon, which is near Bend on the east side of the Cascades. And I'd been a birder for about 10 years. And then at that point, I discovered this region in Central Oregon that has 11 species of woodpeckers. And so I was fascinated by that and kind of just immersed myself, like I said, in woodpecker mania, just doing research, trying to figure out how this phenomenon can happen and learning more about woodpeckers all the time. And it just kind of snowballed.
So what's the phenomenon that you're speaking of specifically?
The fact that we have 11 woodpecker species in a very small geographic area. The region in general has a couple of large watersheds that are abundant with woodpeckers, but there are small sub-watersheds in there that are smaller than 100 square miles that have 11 species of woodpeckers. And 100 square miles might sound like a lot, but it's only 10 miles by 10 miles. So when you think about that, that's a relatively small watershed to have that kind of diversity.
So for example, in the Catskills, I'm not sure I can name them all, but I'm going to guess there's probably five or six.
Yeah, that's about right. There are more than that. There probably are seven.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for us, you know, Downy is probably the smallest, and then up to the pileated or pileated, as you pointed out, which is still one of my favorite things. And I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
What are your favorite woodpeckers, in your region?
Oh gosh. Well, I really like the Lewis's woodpecker. He's kind of a strange woodpecker. He's an aerial insect feeder. So he's kind of actually not very woodpecker-like. And he's kind of a weak excavator. So he doesn't usually even excavate his own cavities. Just has a very interesting life history. So I like the fact that species is kind of an anomaly.
So I have to say, I had not heard of that woodpecker before looking at your book, which is incredible, by the way. I hope.
Thank you.
I imagine it was like the peak, like pouring everything that you've learned and researched in your life, and then obviously done more research just for this book. But I just can't imagine. So I'm currently using a library copy, but I just can't, like, this is an incredible book, and it just has everything and so much in here. It seems to me like I could read this for the rest of my life and still learn something every time I pick it up. So congrats on that.
I still learn things when I look back at it too.
There's a lot in there. But
I know it's a lot of information. And when I lead woodpecker seminars, and when I talk to people, they always say, "Is this in your book? Is this in your book?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's probably in there. If it's not in there, then it needs to go in there."
Well, in doing research, so I've been really interested in woodpeckers for a while, but I started doing more research last fall, and this really fills a huge gap in, I mean, there just aren't many books out there specifically about woodpeckers, and especially not in depth like this. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of books, both nonfiction and fiction, about the ivory build and things of that sort.
Right.
But just generally, like when I was looking for one resource about woodpeckers, this was all I found, really.
There are a couple other books out, but they're... there's one that's more of a coffee table book, and there's Woodpeckers of the World book that came out several years ago. There's another one called The Owl and the Woodpecker, but it's a little bit more of a just narrative style about, it's actually done by a photographer, so kind of showcasing his photography. He's actually one of the photographers in my book. So it is definitely, there are things in my book that have information that's never been compiled in one volume before. So just as one specific example, the information on woodpecker anatomy is spread out over various resource references, but nowhere else is all the information that we know about woodpecker anatomy packed into one source.
Well, let's start there, because there's a lot of, for me, there was a lot of fascinating stuff. I knew about the woodpecker tongue, and that's one of like my party tricks, is I tell people about, like, did you know? And I was surprised to learn that the pileated or pileated woodpecker doesn't actually have the longest tongue of woodpeckers. But I learned all sorts of stuff about the cranium and basically how the whole woodpecker body and anatomy is constructed or serves, you know, the hammering purpose. And I think you kind of build your description of their anatomy, around that. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. Woodpeckers probably have one of the most specialized anatomies of any bird. And the ability to deliver the blows when they hammer their head against a tree and then to reabsorb the resultant forces is totally unique. And it's basically built upon the need to protect the soft tissues of the head. So to protect the brain and the eyes in particular. So they have a suite of adaptations that allow them to deliver blows up to that include up to 1,200 G's of force, which is something that many times what humans can handle. And then when you deliver those blows, you obviously have an opposite reaction, and you've got to be able to protect the head and the eyes from the resultant forces. So they've got, it goes all the way from the cranium down to the lower part of the backbone and the tip of the tail. So I like to say from the tip of the tongue to the tip of the tail, they've got special adaptations. And it's really all about protecting the brain and the eyes.
So how big is a, I don't know much about bird brains, but a woodpecker brain, how big is that?
They may have a proportionately smaller brain than other birds, but brain size is not correlated with intelligence in particular, because woodpeckers are listed sometimes as like the fifth smartest of the bird families. That's behind like raptors and parrots and corvids and one other I can't remember. But they, so the size of the brain is sort of displaced a little bit by the thickness of parts of the cranium. So the frontal bone and the occipital bone in particular are extra thick in the woodpecker, and they contain this network of bony fibers that help disperse force over a large surface area. If you took all those fibers and laid them out, they would be extremely long, and you push them all together into a kind of a mesh, and that mesh is what helps disperse the forces across the various fibers.
So in the book, you talk a little bit about how research into woodpecker craniums has led to all sorts of different things that have helped humans. Can you touch upon a couple of those?
Yeah, you bet. and this is probably something that people are very familiar with, but concussions are a big problem in football. And for years, scientists have studied the woodpecker cranial anatomy to build better football helmets so that football players have fewer injuries. And it's a huge deal. And, you know, we get concussions really easily. And it's amazing to watch football and to watch these guys pounding themselves and realizing that they're all damaging their brains. And it's something that, anyway, I won't go too into the details of that, but, you know, it's, I know that there's one neurologist who says that humans shouldn't even be heading a soccer ball. That also is something that puts certain trauma on the brain. In addition to woodpecker helmets, though, they've also, in the design of bicycle helmets, motorcycle helmets, those have also come out of woodpecker research, as well as protecting electronic devices. There are casings that have been built to protect internal electronic devices with a structure around the casing itself, around the item itself, that is built around the woodpecker cranial anatomy.
Wow. So I have so many things I want to touch on, and I want to be respectful of your time. But one thing, two things before we get away from anatomy. The tongue, so that I don't have to explain it in my stupid party favor way. Can you describe a little bit of what a woodpecker tongue is all about and why it's so unique?
Sure. Humans have a hyoid bone. Helps us extend and retract our fleshy part of our tongue. Woodpeckers instead have a hyoid apparatus, which is a series of bones and muscles that are specially adapted for each of their different types of feeding. So woodpeckers generally all have the same type of hyoid apparatus, but there are some subtle differences based on different feeding behaviors. But in general, the woodpecker tongue is an elongated Y shape. So it's got a single piece here, and then it forks into a Y. And the Y itself is made up of multiple bones. The forward part of the tongue is made up of multiple bones. There's a fused set of bones at the junction, and there's a bone at the tip. So the tip of the tongue is the straight part, and then it splits right at the trachea and goes around the trachea and the backbone and up around the back on the outside of the cranium, around the back of the skull. And then those two pieces sort of follow each other. They don't fuse, but they come together and follow each other, generally toward the right orbital socket. And then every time a woodpecker sticks its tongue out, that whole apparatus unwinds and rewinds. And they have special, each of those bones in that elongated Y, we call that the hyoid horns. So they're, each of those bones is encased in muscle. So there's like a sleeve around each of those sets of bones. Those muscles help extend the tongue. Then there are special muscles attached to the tip. They're paired muscles, two on each side, that then help retract the tongue, and another set of paired hyoid muscles that allow the woodpecker to wiggle the tip of its tongue. So there are two kind of exceptions to that woodpecker tongue or to that hyoid apparatus. One is the sapsuckers. The sapsuckers have a relatively short hyoid that ends back here at the back of the skull. They really only need to stick their tongue into the deepest sap wells, which aren't very deep in the tree. The other big exception is the flicker. The flicker's tongue is extra long, and instead of stopping at the orbital socket, those two hyoid horns continue into the right nasal opening and into the upper mandible. So when a flicker's at rest, both the terminal ends of its tongue and the tip of its tongue are in the mandible, are in the bill. So it's not like you could open their mouth and see those. If you open the mouth, you'd see the tip of the tongue, but the upper parts of the hyoid are in the bill structure of the upper mandible. And again, every time that flicker feeds, it unwinds and rewinds that tongue structure.
So for people who don't know, explain why this tongue is so important and what it does for them, like why woodpeckers need to have these elongated tongues.
Many woodpeckers are feeding into small nooks and crannies, and some of them are feeding into beetle galleries. So a beetle gallery is like a tunnel that's been eaten out by a beetle larva. So some of them feed in beetle and wood boring beetle larval galleries. Some of them feed in bark beetle galleries, which are between the bark and the wood of the tree. And they need to be able to stick that tongue into those larval galleries to retract the prey. The flicker feeds on ants in underground burrows. So it needs to be able to stick its tongue deep into those underground burrows to retract those ants. And a sapsucker, because its tongue is shorter, really only has to stick its tongue as deep as the deepest sap wells. So it just is a good example. Using the sapsucker and flicker as the extreme examples help show how different feeding behaviors are accompanied with the different types of structure of the hyoid apparatus.
So I see a lot of hammering happening across a bunch of different woodpeckers. When I see the hammering, that is not the same as eating, correct? They're hammering and then they're eating, or does it happen both at the same time?
There's two kinds of blows in general that are given. There are feeding type hammering, and then there's drumming. And the drumming, which is that brrrr that you hear early in the morning in the spring on your home, sometimes on your vent pipe for your microwave or your flashing on the side of the house or the chimney pipe or whatever, that's communication only. So that's both courtship and territorial communication. Most woodpecker behaviors are shared between the two sexes. There are very few that are unique to one of the two sexes. Then when you're hearing tapping sounds that are sporadic, like tap, 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 that's excavating type feeding. And so they're either peeling bark flakes or probing behind the bark or getting into the wood of the tree, depending on the species. So there's a real difference in one of them is communication and one of them is feeding behavior.
So I think there's a real miscommunication, and I hope this kind of dovetails into the, I think there's a lot of parallels and intertwining stories between woodpeckers and humans. And, you know, when humans are doing well, woodpeckers are doing well. And I'd like to get into that in a moment, but you did bring up the peeling of bark and the hammering of trees. And I think there's a big misconception that when people see woodpeckers doing this to trees, their quick assumption is that woodpeckers are coming in and killing and destroying trees. That's not right at all, right?
No, that's not the case. most woodpeckers, in fact, are doing absolutely no impact, having no impact on the trees whatsoever. The bark is the dead part of the tree. The outer part of the tree is the dying part. And so those that are flaking bark are really just flaking in the dead material. There are some woodpeckers that can kill trees when they're feeding on bark beetles. Bark beetle larvae will attack trees, but it's not the woodpeckers that are doing the killing, it's the bark beetles. So the bark beetles go in between the bark and the wood of the tree and then end up girdling the tree. But while that's happening, the woodpeckers are going to go in and take advantage opportunistically of feeding on the bark beetle larvae. There are also some occasions when sapsuckers can girdle a tree, especially when it's a non-native tree. Most of the trees in North America that are native have evolved with sapsuckers. And so they have their own defense mechanisms to prevent any kind of damage. There are, especially in non-native trees, however, they don't have the same mechanisms. So woodpeckers can either girdle the tree by just making lots of holes around it so the bark falls off. Or they also can sometimes introduce fungal spores. Woodpeckers are well known to carry fungal spores on their bellies from dragging them up along the surface of a tree. And sometimes they can introduce those fungal spores through their excavations. But in general, you're correct that woodpeckers do not generally damage trees, with those couple exceptions.
So I don't remember the phrase you used. I think I think of woodpeckers as like either the construction workers or the contractors of the forest. I think you used a different phrase in your book, but that leads into this wonderful description of how woodpeckers are keystone organisms. And this ties into what you were just talking about. And can you describe a little bit about what that means and why it's so important to the health of not just our forests, but us?
Yeah, you bet. healthy forest ecosystems in general in North America depend upon woodpeckers. Woodpeckers perform, different species perform, can perform multiple keystone roles. So a keystone roll is one in that if the keystone, which is the woodpecker, is removed, just like a keystone from an arch is removed, the arch will collapse. If the keystone organism in an ecosystem is removed from that ecosystem will suffer some sort of detrimental harm. The primary keystone role that woodpeckers play is the excavation of the nest cavity. And all woodpeckers nest in cavities. And all woodpeckers nest in cavities throughout the year. They'll even roost in cavities. So they're excavating cavities all the time, for the most part. Some species, as I mentioned a little earlier, are weaker excavators and they will reuse cavities. But in general, those that reuse will often expand a cavity. Those cavities, all of those hundreds or however many millions of cavities that are out there in North America, are then used by up to 40 species of birds, not including the woodpeckers themselves, as nesting cavities. Those include several swallow species, wrens, bluebirds, chickadees, nuthatches, small owls like the pygmy owl and the saw-whet owl, and there are even several duck species like the golden eyes and the buffle heads and the wood duck that are adapted for nesting in cavities. So in a forest, it's important that we have a broad succession of age classes in order for the woodpeckers to maintain this ecological role. And what we tend to have is when we've cut trees is we have all the same age class through the stands of forest. And that means we're lacking snags or dead trees. And a healthy forest has everything from seedlings, saplings, small, medium, and large trees up to large mature trees and dead and dying trees. And the woodpeckers can then more effectively play their role of excavator when we have healthy forests. And as we are tied to healthy ecosystems, we have this kind of indirect attachment to woodpeckers. If woodpeckers aren't able to perform their role in keeping forests healthy, then if there's any kind of harm that would befall us, that would be something that we would run into.
So where you are in Oregon, what is the state of the woodpecker population?
It's pretty good, actually. We have some species that are considered sensitive, and that's because of specialization. So that's not necessarily due to habitat loss. In some cases, it is due to changes in habitat. But just as one example, the black-backed woodpecker in our region can be considered sensitive because it has a very specialized diet. It eats 90% of its diet is wood-boring beetle larvae. And so if the forest is not healthy, then it's not going to have a lot of wood-boring beetle larvae. If it's all even age stands of live trees, there won't be wood borers in there. And so those blackbacks won't have food. There are other specialized species like the white-headed woodpecker in our region that's sensitive. The white-headed, through a large part of the year, feeds on the seeds of live, unopened pine cones. So it's boring into the green pine cones and taking the seeds out. So it needs large, mature pine trees that have large cone crops that'll help support that feeding behavior. It also probes and gleans in the bark surfaces. So larger, more mature trees have greater surface area, which allow better feeding opportunities for the white-headed. So there are some species that are sensitive, but in general, we don't have any threatened or endangered species.
So where you live, do you put bird food out in your yard or your garden, and do you see woodpeckers regularly?
Yes, we have. Anytime we put out suet or peanuts out of the shell, the woodpeckers like that. They'll come to suet year round. They'll even feed their young suet if it's available. excuse me, at my house, we do have feeders out occasionally. I actually am traveling a good part of the year, so I'm not at home maintaining the feeders, but I know that when I'm home and the feeders are full, we do see woodpeckers. And in my particular home, I'm a little bit east of the heart of this woodpecker wonderland, we call it. So at my house, we have mostly hairy, flicker, sometimes white-headed, sometimes downy, but it's really mostly hairy and flicker. But you don't have to go very far, even just 5 miles west, and you start getting into that area where there are a lot more, where the diversity is much higher.
Okay, so do you prefer pileated or pileated?
I probably say pileated more often than pileated, but and I'll defer to Webster, which says both are correct.
Yeah. So I said pileated forever. And I had never even heard of the bird before I lived in the Catskills. So I've known about them for about 15 years because there are quite a few here. And I always said pileated, and I had too many conversations with people who they wouldn't correct me, but they would just respond by saying pileated.
Yeah.
And now that's stuck in my head. And one of the things I was so happy to learn in your book was you can say either. And I, in some ways I feel like people don't talk enough about this bird. It's the biggest woodpecker in America, in part because nobody knows how the hell to say it.
Yeah, that's a good point. It reminds me of the use of the word can and may. Can I do something for you or may I do something for you? You might say it wrong and then the person's going to say it correctly without correcting you. It's kind of the same thing. There's this general acceptance that in the East they say pileated, in the West we say pileated. So I find it mixed in either region, but in general, I think people in the East are more likely to say pileated. And it's the name comes from this part of the head, which is called the pilium or the pilium. And so the feathers that come out as a crest out the back are in that part of the crown. So it really comes down to how you pronounce that, an anatomical part of their body.
Okay, so because I'm in the East today and representing the Catskills, I will say pileated, but
I won't correct you.
But I may go back, or maybe I'll just, whenever I'm out West, I'll switch. But so one of the things that happened this winter, so over the years, we've had pileated in our yard, and also we have what we call the gully, like the second half of our yard, which is basically a rewilding zone these days. Lots and lots of trees, and so we've had lots of pileateds over the years. However, this past year, for the first time in January, at the suet, which I can watch outside of my atrium doors, a pileated became part of its daily routine. And so for anywhere from like an hour to 3 hours every afternoon, this pileated would come and visit. And it didn't like to actually stand or hold on to the suet feeder cage.
Right.
I had arranged it, not purposely, so that it's right next to a tree trunk, in part because I don't mind if the squirrels eat off of it as well. And so it would do all these wonderful machinations to hang off of the tree and then work at the suet. And I got to spend a lot of, like, many hours this winter when there's not much else going on, really observing this bird. And it really, we named them Steina. I think based on the markings, I think it's a male, but who cares? The bird's name is Steina. And it really just like, it felt really magical to get to spend all this time with this bird. And it came every day, at least that I looked, for probably about 3 months. I haven't really seen it recently because it's got plenty of other things now, of course, to eat. But I'm just wondering if you can tell me, like, what are some of the things that blow your mind about the pileated itself?
Sure. It's one of the largest woodpeckers in the world. It's probably in the top 10 or 15 out of 220 plus species. And so it's pushing the ecological limits of organisms in the woodpecker family. That makes it, in some senses, challenged because it does have some specialized ecological requirements. But the pileated has shown itself to be very resilient. Back in the early settlement times, the pileated woodpeckers in the East declined dramatically. There were even naturalists that were concerned about them getting extirpated from certain areas because of the clearing of the land. But what happened, in general, pileated woodpeckers are adapted for old growth or mature forest. They're feeding on carpenter ants, and so they need dead, rotten wood on the ground, and they need dead, rotten snags standing. So carpenter ants are their favorite food. And when you remove the dead and dying trees, and you remove mature trees that are going to become dead and dying trees, then you put the pileated woodpecker in jeopardy. However, after a lot of those original lands that we cleared were left abandoned, and the forest reclaimed those lands, pileated woodpeckers became adapted to second growth forest. And so that's kind of a neat example of flexibility in adaptation. As long as the food's available in some form, the bird will do fine. And the pileateds have recovered dramatically in the east. And you have a lot more pileated woodpeckers in the east than we do at least in my part of the west. In the far west, you get into the rainforest areas, and they're fairly common, but they're still not as common as they are in the east. And in general, that's because your humidity's higher. So you have a lot more wet forest, and you've got forests that are they're rotting and have this food source available for them. Mm-hmm. Where I live, our pileated woodpeckers have large territories. People often ask, how big is the territory? Well, it's not defined strictly. It's defined based on habitat quality. So the habitat quality where I live is relatively poor for pileated, so they have very large territories, and we have few individuals on the east side of the Cascades. When you go to the west side of the Cascades and the coast ranges, or in your region, they have relatively small territories, so they're more common and more abundant, and you're able to see them more often and in more places.
What is it besides their size? Are there any other things that are really striking about them compared to either other woodpeckers or just other birds in general?
In general, their size also kind of puts them in a unique behavioral situation for flight. Pileated woodpeckers don't do the typical undulations that most woodpeckers do, where they are flying, they undulate, they dip when they fly. Pileateds generally fly directly. And so that's kind of unique. Most people think of woodpecker flight as undulating. But pileateds are often flying above the canopy, but even when they're flying in the canopy, they're generally flying straight. They also have relatively large broods. Flickers have the largest broods of all of the North American woodpeckers, but the pileateds also will consistently fledge two and sometimes even more young out of a nest. A lot of woodpeckers get by fledging one or two, as opposed to two or three. Also, the pileated woodpecker cavity is really important ecologically for some of the larger cavity nesters. So, for example, a wood duck can't nest in a hairy woodpecker cavity. It has to have a pileated cavity. Most of the ducks that are cavity nesters need pileated cavities, including bufflehead, golden eyes, mergansers, wood duck, and a couple of others. So the pileated cavity itself is an important resource for other birds out there, as well as mammals. There are pine martens and other mammal species that use woodpecker cavities, and the pileated cavity is really important for those.
Do these tend to be at the lower end of trees, or does it just depend?
You mean lower in height?
No, I'm sorry. I mean, like, based on where the trunk begins, do woodpeckers or pileateds especially, are they going to focus on that first 10 feet from the ground?
Not at all. We have a nest we found this year that's in a 120-foot tree, and the nest is about 80 feet up. So it really just depends on the tree itself. It depends on what the decay class of the tree is. And so if the decay class is relatively high, they can nest anywhere in the tree. A lot of these trees that are rotting will rot from the ground up. And so they might, in those cases, nest lower on the tree.
Are there, what are the predators for something as big as a pileated?
The pileated woodpecker has very few predators at all. A northern goshawk might be bold enough to try to take a pileated woodpecker down, but they're about the same size. And that bill and those claws on a woodpecker are pretty formidable. There are nest predators. That's probably the biggest threat. When you've got pileated woodpecker nestlings, there might be rodents or mustelids that might get into those cavities and depredate a nest. In the east, you might even get black rat snakes that climb trees that can get into a pileated cavity. But if a pileated is around and it sees that black rat snake coming into its nest cavity, you can bet there's going to be a fight. I saw a video recently of a rat snake taking a flicker down, but I think a rat snake would have a really hard time with a pileated.
Is there anything that I didn't ask that you love to jump up and down about regarding woodpeckers that I may have missed?
I don't think so. You really hit the highlights. The keystone roll and the anatomy. Those are two of the most important things to talk about with woodpeckers. Maybe the other thing is woodpeckers also get a bad reputation. A lot of people know about woodpeckers because of the way they drum on their houses and even sometimes excavate in their houses. But there are easy solutions to those problems. And I encourage people to get in touch with me and ask me, and I'm more than happy to share the information with them. We don't have time to go too much into it here, but there are solutions to those problems, and woodpeckers don't have to be your enemies. You can provide other resources for them that will allow them to practice their behaviors and their lifestyle without causing damage to your property. You just need to be a little creative and practice some sustainable solutions.
That was naturalist and friend to the woodpecker, Steve Shunk. Learn more about his woodpecker tours at paradisebirding.com. You should also go read his Peterson Reference Guide to Woodpeckers of North America. Pretty tremendous book, which I got a copy of at the Cairo Library. And since Steve did such a wonderful job of talking a bit about woodpecker sounds, the percussive drum roll that they use as a way of communication, let's end the show today with Zakir Hussain and Giovanni Hidalgo from the album Masters of Percussion. Here's the track, Geezy.